Okay, we are live in the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse in the landmark cast iron building at 67 East 11th Street in Greenwich Village, New York City. Thank you to everybody who's here. To those listening to the podcast, you have no idea how packed the clubhouse is tonight, but take our word for it. I'm just going to be very brief in these comments. As we always say, to those who are here for the first time, welcome. To those who have been to the clubhouse before, welcome home. It's now my honor and pleasure to become the bullpen catcher for the rest of the night and turn it over to Kara Canella, the host of the Speakeasy series.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. Kara Canella. Speakeasy series is a roughly monthly kind of roving conversation series. Started in Brooklyn in February of this year, and I'm really excited to be here tonight. Chad, we have really close mutual friends, which is kind of how this all came about. They're all from beautiful Racine, Wisconsin, where I can't wait to go there. And what else? It all just came about like pretty organically. I had another venue lined up, which kind of fell through, and my friend Patrick Sauer, who has written about Jay and the clubhouse, you know, suggested this as an alternative. So grateful. It's kind of perfect. And it's very New York to me. It's like someone's obsession. You know, you can find anyone's obsession in New York, and this is the baseball manifestation of that. And then I'd like to thank my intern, Alana Levinson. She's been so helpful through all this. And Chris Paris Lamb, who's Chad's agent, and Chad himself, who wrote the beautiful book, The Art of Fielding. Thanks to everyone for coming. So we're going to start with Chad doing a little reading. It'll be pretty brief, and it's one of my favorite sections of the book. It's close to the beginning. So.
Yeah. Can I hold that beer?
Mm-hmm. So, by the way, I'd like to thank Harpoon Brewery for sponsoring and and another little twist of everything just kind of falling into place. The team in the book, you know, the main character plays on, and it's the focus of the book is the Harpooners. So, Harpoon Brewery. Thanks.
Well, thanks everybody for coming. This is awesome. I see that old school brewer's hat over there from maybe like about 1979 or something, and already covered it. But I'm going to start by reading a very short section from very early in the book. And this is a passage that contains quite a bit, several sort of mantras from the book within the book, which is called The Art of Fielding.
Kara, is this your marginalia?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Kara's writing a paper about the book.
There'll be a quiz later of everyone.
Henry had been reading Aparicio on the overnight bus, or at least he'd kept the book open on his lap as the dreary slabs of interstate rolled by. By this point in his life, reading Aparicio no longer really qualified as reading, because he had the book more or less memorized. He could flip to a chapter, any chapter, and the shapes of the short, numbered paragraphs were enough to trigger his memory. His lips murmured the words as his eyes, unfocused, scanned the page. Number 26. The shortstop is a source of stillness at the center of the defense. He projects this stillness, and his teammates respond. Number 59. To field a ground ball must be considered a generous act and an act of comprehension. One moves not against the ball, but with it. Bad fielders stab at the ball like an enemy. This is antagonism. The true fielder lets the path of the ball become his own path, thereby comprehending the ball and dissipating the self, which is the source of all suffering and poor defense. Number 147, throw with the legs. Aparicio had played shortstop for the St. Louis Cardinals for 18 seasons. He retired the year Henry turned 10. He was a first ballot Hall of Famer and the greatest defensive shortstop who ever lived. As a ball player, Henry had modeled himself after his hero in every particular, from the gliding, two-handed way he fielded grounders, to the way he wore his cap pulled low to shield his eyes, to the three taps he gave his heart before stepping into the batter's box, and, of course, the jersey number. Aparicio believed that the number 3 had deep significance. Number 3, There are three stages: thoughtless being, thought, return to thoughtless being. Number 33, do not confuse the first and third stages. Thoughtless being is attained by everyone, the return to thoughtless being by a very few. There were, admittedly, many sentences and statements in the art that Henry did not yet understand. The opaque parts of the art, though, had always been his favorites, even more than the detailed and extremely helpful descriptions of, say, how to keep a runner close to second base, flirtation, Aparicio called it, or what sort of cleats to wear on wet grass. The opaque parts, frustrating as they could be, gave Henry something to aspire to. Someday, he dreamed, he would be enough of a ball player to crack them open and suck out their hidden wisdom. Number 213, death is the sanction of all that the athlete does.
Okay, also, this is why I should keep little notes or lists. My brother, Steve Cannella, who's the baseball editor of Sports Illustrated, is also joining us. And he's going to come up next to talk to Chad about all the baseball stuff, which is good because I barely know who won the World Series. I hear it was a great series, though. Chad was just reading, Chris, you know, noticed your face. You're, like, obviously still delighting in this book. You're kind of chuckling to yourself, right? And so the story of Chris and Chad's kind of teamwork, you know, is interesting in light of the book being a lot about teamwork. I feel like you guys are more of like an agent-author duo than, you know, I've ever encountered. And I don't know, have you guys seen this story? Vanity Fair was a big feature about the selling of the book, which was kind of newsworthy. Here's Chris, Marlena, publicist, the whole team, book designer. But in this article, wrote the October issue. Here's Chad. I'm totally embarrassing you. In this article, there's an email that Chris wrote to Chad upon receiving the book that I love it. Like, when I first read this, I had, you know, visceral reaction, kind of chills. And so I'll read it. I'm not going to make Chris read it. So this is an excerpt. So this is the, I guess, after he finished the book. He wrote one, hey, I'm 200, you know, 50 pages into the book, and then this is the one that followed that when he had finished it. This is the horriest cliche an agent or editor can offer, so you'll have to forgive me for lacking novelty, but I love this book in a way that reminded me of why I got into this business. Watching this novel unfold, I felt like Mike Schwartz, who's a character, at that field in Peoria when he first discovered Henry, and I saw something of myself in 22-year-old Schwartzy at the end of the novel, too. Those who can't or can no longer do coach. Those who love books but whose appreciation for what it takes to write great ones makes them all the more aware that they'll never have what it takes. Well, we go into publishing. And we both hope that one day we'll have the chance to actually work with books that make us feel like the ones we read back before reading was a job. I can only imagine what kind of competition I'm up against to represent you, and I'm going to do everything I can to convince you that I should be your agent. Et cetera, et cetera. I'm skipping a little just for time.
There's some good stuff.
It was very beautiful, all that stuff.
That said, if you'll give me the chance, I'm going to work like hell to see that it gets the publication and reception and readership it deserves. Books like The Art of Fielding and writers of your caliber don't come around very often. In the final reckoning, agents are ultimately only as good as the books they represent, and you're giving someone a shot here to be the best. So what was your reaction from getting that email? How did the book end up in Chris's lap?
Yeah. Well, the book ended up in, well, you know.
What was your reaction to getting the email?
It was, you know, if it was amazing and it felt amazing, it's a little embarrassing to talk about, you know.
It's all out there.
I originally got into contact with Chris through my friend Allison Lorenzen, who is one of my co-editors at N+1 magazine and was at the time at HarperCollins and is now at Penguin, and she was sort of my guide through the process, through this whole like sort of education that I received and like how to try to sell a book. And so I was like, Allison, to whom should I send my book? And she said, you have to send your book to Chris Paris Lamb. And I was like, and I was like, Chris Perez Lamb, he's like 14 years old.
Now he's 15.
And, yeah, this was a couple years ago. And she was like, no, Chris Perez, he's like the best, he's the greatest. He's going to love this book. You have to send it to him. And then I sent it to him, and he read it very quickly. He read it more quickly than some other agents read the book. And then I got this beautiful email, which I don't even, what can you?
Yeah, it was a no-brainer at that point, I guess. Mm-hmm. So, had you ever, felt this way? It sounds like you never felt this way about a book.
Have you ever felt this way before? Because I haven't.
Well, you are an expert on bromance.
That's true.
No, I can safely say I hadn't. In fact, I mean, it's cynical to say, like, I played this card, but when I was selling the book, I said something that, you can really only ever say as an agent one time. And as a young agent, I was calling people, including Michael Peach, who bought the book, who I'd never sent things to before, and asking them to kind of drop what they were doing and pay attention to the book. And I said, this is the best book I've ever read in manuscript. The only books I can compare this to are the things I read that made me want to go into publishing. Mm-hmm.
What were some of those? Who were some influential writers?
The Keith's piece talks a lot about Wallace. Wallace definitely was. David Foster Wallace. I loved writers like reading Dave Eggers at age 19. Like had a big influence on me. Kurt Vonnegut, Zadie Smith.
And I'm just wondering if you guys have similar sensibilities. I know David Foster Wallace is also someone who means a lot to you. Do you feel like you kind of have overlapping tastes or?
Well, yeah, certainly. Yeah. I mean, we Chris and I, we talked. I remember early on in the process having a conversation with Chris about, because David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest, which it came out just before I was graduated from college, and it was a book which I was reading as I graduated from college, and for me it was a really sort of profound experience reading that book, because it served as a kind of bridge for me between, because you go to college, and when I went to college we didn't have the internet.
A little college called Harvard.
We didn't have the Facebook. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have the internet, and we didn't have all these things that the kids have today. So it really felt like if you were studying literature, or you were studying history, or you were studying these things in college, at least at that time. I don't know how it feels right now, but you kind of felt like you were immersed in like a completely sort of past world. Mm-hmm. And so you read these books, and like you were like a contemporary writer is Nabokov, because he was writing in like the 50s, mm-hmm. And you kind of had no conception that this tradition that you were steeped in and loved and that you would kind of organize your life around was continuous and like existed in the present day. And so for me, when I read that book just as I was graduating from college, that was a book which really made me feel like wow, this kind of thing can be done right now. Like I could, if I were good enough at it, I could become a writer today because it's possible, to do this thing in the contemporary world. So that was a very important book for me in just sort of like deciding to do this thing of trying to write a novel. And then I recall early on in meeting Chris, he told me something similar about reading Infinite Jest when he was at University of North Carolina, and how that book kind of was partly the cause of him getting into the publishing industry, mm-hmm. taking his first internship and all those things, if I'm not misstating your position.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, in some ways I had like opposite response from you in the sense that, like, I, you know, I like Harvard writerly ambitions in college, but reading Infinite Jest for me kind of made me feel like made me realize like that I couldn't do this. I couldn't write, like, but that I appreciated it, and that someone edited it, someone you know, publicized it, someone
and you're
represented it.
Your beautifully written email to Chad is how this all happened too. So partly,
well,
yeah.
You know.
All right, and so the tagline of Speakeasy, the series, is conversations with artists and entrepreneurs. So, Chris, how, you know, as an agent, is your job entrepreneurial? I imagine it is, right? You're kind of managing a business within a business, and can you just explain that and maybe, like, how working on Chad's book has fit into that? And
I would say it's very entrepreneurial in spirit. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my particular case, you know, I owe everything to, you know, David Gerner, who took a chance on me and promoted me long before I was ready, much less profitable from his standpoint. So that's not very entrepreneurial in the sense that, you know, like having someone to pay you a salary and insulate you from the vicissitudes of trying to build a list as a young agent. But certainly in spirit, you know, day to day, it's like you're, you know, you're building something. You're looking for writers, ideally, that you want to be working with, like, over the course of your entire career. There's a lot of noise out there, you know, whether it's in the form of all the queries you receive or all the articles you're out there reading or... you know, every day you're kind of looking for that thing that comes through the noise. But the truth is things only come through the noise, like, once or twice a year. So you have to be ready to, like, you have to be ready for them, even though 99% of it is noise. Like, you have to kind of be prepared when something comes through that isn't. You know, when the music comes through, so to speak. And, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Entrepreneurial, like, we work on commission.
Like wheeling and dealing.
Yes. I mean, it's you know, you kill what you eat. So it's like, you know, there's the economics of it are very simple.
Exciting in this
You
state.
Have to be doing business and you have to be selling books and, you know, I didn't get into this because I wanted to be a salesman. I got into this because I want to work with books. And so I want to be able to... you know, be doing business, but also working with books that I really believe in and am proud of.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be difficult at times, but it can also pay off, which is like the best feeling in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we talked about this a little earlier, but I kind of see like a common thread with, you know, your, you know, in some interview you called it a duty to bring, you know, good literature into the world and, or shepherd it into the world. And, you know, in Chad's case, working on this book for 10 years, your strong feelings about your vocation. My brother, who's now the Sports Illustrated, you know, baseball editor growing up, he had piles of Sports Illustrated by his bed. Even my doing this series, you know, it's just kind of like a out of love. And so this baseball shop, it's just, I think it's interesting when all this stuff comes together. So, and there's a reason why it does, you know, sort of like a magnetism. All right. So let's see. What I don't know. How have you guys like gotten to know each other? What's this relationship like now?
Well, I've gotten Chad doing track workouts with me. I'm like a kind of an obsessive runner.
You're running the marathon.
Running the marathon on Sunday. Yes.
Okay. And drinking a beer right now.
And drinking a beer. Yes. Like
he's carbo loading.
A harpoon beer.
Yes. So yeah. It's all right. I've fallen off the wagon a little bit, and But,
do you run together?
Well, we don't run. I mean, Chris doesn't really understand how old I am, for one thing.
Wait, did we card you for that beer? No, I'm kidding.
Chris is getting old himself, but
I'm almost 30.
Yeah, I don't know if this is really germane to the conversation, but Chris runs long distances, and once in a while he runs a short enough distance that I can manage to do it. So we have these, like, It's like this sort of Venn diagram that like overlaps like just for...
You can probably be my bench president.
Yes.
Anyway.
Maybe.
So
stick around.
What was your background with baseball? And we'll get to you. We'll get to you a bunch later. Chris,
Wow. Yeah, I mean, from what I can tell from talking to him about it, it seems like Chad and I had like pretty similar, similarly baseball obsessed childhoods. I mean, it was one of my earliest memories is my father telling me to keep my eye on the ball and throwing me wiffle balls and teaching me to throw and catch. And I played really seriously all through childhood. Played seriously in high school and was like a pretty good pitcher and got I was recruited at a really really low level of college, like possibly below Westish, if that's possible, or maybe I would have been like the fourth pitcher in the rotation at Westish, and then as is now in the record for all time in Vanity Fair now, I didn't make the club team at UNC. So.
He's wiping away a tear.
But baseball was a huge part of my life. And if anything, I came into reading Chad's book with like this kind of supercilious kind of like, well, let's see if this guy can write about can really write about baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And it took like three pages for me to.
Right. In a very easy, natural way. And I mean, this
totally.
Has been published elsewhere too, but one of your close friends got what 2/3 way through the book and said, what's a shortstop? When the main character is a shortstop. So it's not really vital to understand the, you don't have to know who won the World Series to love the book, So I'm a good example of that. So, all right, Chris, well, thank you.
Thank you.
And Steve, do you want to swap seats? And okay.
Good luck, Steve.
It's nice over there in the green room. We're going to enjoy it.
All right. So this is my big brother, Steve Canella. We grew up in Connecticut. He has worked at Sports Illustrated since basically the week he graduated college, right?
2 weeks.
Had different sort of career paths. But he has gone through a few different roles there. I'll just let you tell everyone what you've done there.
How long do we have? I've fact-checked. I've researched. I've written about baseball, I've written about hockey, I've written about lots of other sports. I've edited our front of the book section, which is called Scorecard, and for the last 2 years, I've been our baseball editor. And I got, you're stuck looking at me now, because this summer, Chris sent the galley of Chad's book and an excerpt that they had put together. I sent it over to us, and I had heard of Chad's book about a year and a half ago when you signed the deal, and I'd read about it in the paper, and I remember thinking at the time, wow, that's a serious fiction baseball novel. That's something you don't hear about every day. I'm kind of curious about that. So when Chris sent the book over, it eventually made its way to me, and I read it this summer, and everything Chris wrote was email. That's how I felt about it too, I guess. But it was, it blew me away, just, the quality of the book, both as a piece of fiction writing. But, I thought he pulled off something that's really hard to do, which is he got the baseball right. And I remember reading it and thinking, for sure, this guy, what an amazing talent. Not only can he write very well, he had to have played in the minor leagues or something like that, because it felt real. And that's, you read a lot of nonfiction sports books that don't feel as real as this one did. So, anyway, so we were able to put together an excerpt. We ran it in August, and it's, in my opinion, one of the best things we've had in the magazine this year. The section we excerpted was part of the book where Henry, the main character, I won't give too much away if you haven't read it, but he sort of has his last, final, total and complete meltdown on the field. He totally loses the ability to do what has come completely natural to him all his life. And he sort of walks off the field in shame, and that's a very pivotal point in the book.
So psychological block, big time.
Yeah, that's to put it mildly. Yes, yeah. But we'll talk about that a little bit.
And I just want to say these two, I don't know you very well, Chad, but, you know, from what I can tell, kind of have an eerie amount in common. You know, both baseball obsessed, both great writers. And Steve's boss, Terry McDonald, the editor of Sports Illustrated, wrote a pretty nice write-up about Steve in early this year. Was it April or so? But he talks about your kind of obsession with, you know, the writing, the editing, but also the statistics, the math part. Steve was like an English and a math major in college, and Chad, from what I hear, you can be a math geek, too. Like, our mutual friend, Sarah Huck, told me that you guys, when you were growing up, she and her sister would pose, like, math problems to you, and you would solve them very quickly in your head, so...
Yeah, I can't do that. That's like you... That.
That's what you guys did in Racine. That's definitely not what we did in New Britain, Connecticut.
There's not a lot to do in Racine. Yeah,
so anyway.
We'll do the rest of this in binary code then, if you all can
read it. So anyway, these two have these very like well-developed, balanced brains, yeah, from what I can tell. So, and I think, you know, that must make you appreciate baseball a lot, the numbers, statistics side of it. So, all right, Steve, go right ahead.
All right, let's make Chad talk a little bit. All right, I guess my first question is, I'm going to undercut the whole setting of where we are right now, and there's a lot of baseball talk, but this is not really a baseball book. It's, you know, it's a love story. It's, someone used the term bromance earlier. It's a family drama. It's a story about friendship. It's a story about mistakes people made and their pursuit of perfection in several walks of life and how they deal with things when they inevitably make those mistakes. But the setting is baseball, and, you know, a lot of people have said this is a book about baseball the way Moby Dick is a book about whaling, to use a cliched phrase. But
there's a lot of whaling.
There's a lot of whaling. In fact, it might be more about whaling. But
there's a lot of Moby Dick in this book.
So I guess my question is, especially you referred to this sort of, you know, tradition, writing tradition that you felt like you could be a part of. Serious baseball fiction, serious sports fiction is not a huge part of that. So why is this a baseball book and not the art of restaurant building or the art of doctoring or the art of football or the art of music or something like that? What is it about baseball that made you feel like you can get a novel out of all this?
Yeah, good question, Steve.
Sit over there.
I mean, a lot of reasons. I mean, I think you could get... I think, you know, I'm so... This is... I'm often... I'm a little bit surprised by the fact that there aren't kind of, I mean, there are some, and there are some very good ones, but I'm sometimes surprised that there aren't more, like, serious sports novels, mm-hmm, that come out, because to me it seems, on the one hand, like a really just kind of, you know, really rich topic for fiction, and then on the other hand, such a sort of kind of major and serious part of our society and our culture, you know, that I think it could bear an awful lot of kind of exploration and inquiry in this kind of way. You know, for me, the book really started with baseball because for me, the initial germ of the book was, you know, Henry's struggle, mm-hmm, you know, and his like kind of psychological inability to throw the ball. And, you know, this was because I had seen this happen to a lot of, you know, really, and right around the time I started the book, which was a really long time ago, like around like 2000, this was right before and right after there were like three or four really prominent players to, mm-hmm, whom it happened, you know, Chuck Knobloch maybe most famously, and Rick Ankiel from the Cardinals, Mark Wolders from the Braves, and, you know, so as a fan I was watching this happen, and it's really sort of like profound to see this happen to somebody, because you have these athletes who are really sort of accustomed and trained to present themselves in like a very particular way, in which you see certain kinds of emotion out of them, you know, but you don't actually, I mean, you know this probably better than I, you know, you talk to a lot more professional athletes than I have. They don't really give you much, right? You know? And, you know, they don't give you much when you're talking to them, and they don't give you much when they're out on the field. Mm-hmm. But the guys to whom this is happening, they kind of crack a little bit, you know? And you can see something that's, like, very vulnerable, very kind of you know, scary, you know, in there when this happens. I mean, I saw a game in Milwaukee where this was happening to Mark Wohlers, and he had been having this trouble for a while. The Braves brought him into a game. They were trying to kind of ease him back in, and they were down by, you know, 5 or 6 runs, so they brought him into the game. And he gets out there, and he was a guy who, like, had been an all-star the previous season, and he's just, like, throwing the ball, like, to the screen. And, like, the whole stadium is just, like, hushed because everyone's just like, oh, my God, like, Lord have mercy on this poor man, you know? It's, like, it's really, like, sort of terrifying. So I just thought that was, like, a really...
Like the public and private aspect.
Yeah, exactly, because it's like because it's all like taking place in this guy's head. You know, it's all internal. The struggle is like all kind of private and psychological, but it has to play out in this really like public, dramatic way where anybody who wants can like come and watch. Mm-hmm. So I thought, yes, exactly, like that combination of the public and private seemed like a novelist could really do something with that. Mm-hmm.
What did you? I mean, talk about athletes not giving you much. We historically, we especially haven't gotten much from the athletes who have suffered from this. You know, people try to talk to Wohlers, people try to talk to Ankiel, people try to talk to Knobloch about this problem, which is named after Steve Glass, who was a Pirates pitcher in the 70s, who was very good, and then showed up in spring training 1 year, and all of a sudden he can throw a strike.
Who
and
I called Bill Blass last week.
Bill
to
Blass.
Steve.
Yeah. I was going to be nice and keep that quiet. So I guess my question is, what we don't know a lot about the people who are going through this. How did you research that? Did you do much research, or did not knowing a lot of that allow you to sort of give you some freedom to crawl inside these people's heads and imagine what they might be thinking? And if so, what in your life sort of gave you something that might have been a corollary to what they were going through?
Yeah.
Don't cry.
He's been doing this a while.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, it's exactly as you say. There was, you know, like the guys to whom it happens give you so little. And there's been so little written about it.
Right.
You know, there's a famous the famous Roger Angel piece from the 70s about Steve Blass, which kind of was the initial description of this whole phenomenon. And it's a beautifully written essay, but Mr. Angel does not really have any. He doesn't really get inside of it. You know, he tells you about Steve Blass's life and what his life is like kind of afterwards. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't really get inside of it very well.
I'm sorry, this is for The New Yorker, by the way. Right?
New Yorker. It's like a famous essay from The New Yorker from like 1975 or something. And, you know, so there just had been, there was just so, like, I mean, I don't want to, I never want to research anything, you know. So the fact that this seemed like totally impossible to research, like just seemed great. I was able to just you know make it up from
you can't
from,
be wrong.
From whole plot. I mean, you could be wrong. And in fact, I mean, I guess I'll say one nice compliment to myself, which one of the nicest things that anyone has said to me throughout this whole process, I had the honor a couple weeks ago. I did this event at Wrigley Field, mm-hmm. and the MC of the event was Bob Tewksbury, who was a long time major league pitcher, who then
he's a psychologist, right?
What's that?
He's a psychologist now.
Yeah, he went and went back and like got an advanced degree in psychology, and now is like a team psychologist for the Red Sox. And
he's busy this
guy. He's working really hard. But he like took a few hours to come to Chicago. But Mr. Tewksbury, unlike Ernie Banks, who was also on the panel, had read my book. and
worried too.
And was like, and I was like, and I was like, and he was really into it. And I was like, I could tell that he was really into it. And I was like, oh man, this like guy who actually knows what he's talking about, like he's really into it. Because it's your, you know, it's your, because of course it's your fear, like kind of writing this thing from the outside as a person who just like, you know, played baseball in high school or whatever, that someone who actually knew what they were talking about was just going to be like, this is like some serious, you know, bullshit, you know. but in fact, he was like, I really think you got it, that phenomenon, I really think you sort of got it right. And I think if I did sort of get it right, I think I got it right. I mean, of course, I like kind of brought to bear my own experience playing baseball and just kind of, you know, being a sort of pretty good high school shortstop with a sort of mediocre arm and just sort of always having a certain fear in my heart about having to make like a long, make like a long throw, you know? But I think it comes more from, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's, you know, I think I just drew more on just a sort of more sort of general experience of trying to become a writer or trying to become whatever you're trying to become in your life, and then just sort of running up against the sort of profound sort of self-doubt that you run up against all along the way, no matter what you're doing. Like, you know, is this really for me? Is this really, like, was I really meant to be doing this? Like, you know, am I not really bad at this? You know?
What, another thing I found interesting is, all right, so once you choose baseball, is where you want to go. The facet of the game that you focus on, defense, fielding, it's not the most glamorous part of the game. It's every kid dreams of hitting a home run to win the World Series. Nobody dreams of fielding a clean two-hopper short to win the World Series. But what is it about that aspect of the game that, you know, sort of, what are you drawn to about fielding and defense? And why wasn't, you know, you could have written about Steve Blass' disease and made Henry a pitcher.
Right.
Why'd you make him a fielder?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, that probably is because I was, you know, in my own experience playing baseball, a fielder and not a pitcher, you know. And to me, like, that was always, from the time I was, like, you know, I don't know, like 4 years old or something, like, I just wanted somebody to hit me ground balls. Like, I just want, you know, it sounds weird, I know. But, like, it was just a sort of pure joy to me to, like, be there and, like, there's a, you know, and, like, can I get all the way over there? Like, or, you know, can I get, you know, and I'm, like, a little kid, so you have to, you know, it's like, but, you know, so, you, like, you know, and it was, you know, so just sort of, it just felt like this sort of very beautiful and powerful activity to sort of expand the sphere of your, you know, how wide can you sort of expand the sphere of your own influence, right? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what a fielder does. It's just sort of like, you know, you're standing there at a particular spot, and, like, how much of this space can you command? And that always felt very, that always felt really great to me, like, when I was young. And so I always really admired players who were able to do that really well, you know. And I sort of, you know, I'm a Brewers fan, and so I, like, hate the Cardinals, you know. Like, there's nothing I hate.
Well, they just won the World Series.
Yeah, it was a horrible thing. But Henry, the kind of hero of the book, is a lifelong huge Cardinals fan, and, you know, and the Cardinals are, like, pursuing him to try to draft him, and, like, the Cardinals are, like, the team that kind of runs throughout the book.
So,
and actually,
deep down, you hate Henry, don't you?
Well, I don't know if I hate Henry, but I had the experience in the last couple of weeks where, because there's Twitter, and there's the...
There is.
I don't know if you know about this thing, but you can learn all sorts of stuff on there. And there were a couple of people who were reading my book and tweeting at the same time, and were like, oh my God, I'm really into the Cardinals now because I'm reading this book, and so I really hope the Cardinals win. And I was like, oh no, I'm not on Twitter. I can't warn them.
You're God, basically.
I can't warn them about what a bad idea that is. But part of the reason why Henry is a Cardinals fan in the book is because when I was a little kid, even though I was a Brewers fan, you know, Ozzie Smith was the one kind of single player who I thought was, you know, the sort of single most gorgeous baseball player who ever lived. Mm-hmm. And, like, I still kind of believe that. He was able to do things that no one else has ever been able to do. Yeah. So you know, even though he was on the team that I hated, I, like, would watch him any time.
Well, that answered my question. Who, although Ozzy, I was going to ask you, who is Aparicio? Who were you imagining?
Ozzy on
the field, but Ozzy didn't have that sort of Sun Tzu aspect to
that. To those who haven't read it, he's the author of the book within
right,
the book, and a former pro. Go ahead.
Well, that section that Chad wrote was quoting from this book, the book within the book, The Art of Feeling, which is sort of this guide to playing defense, but also sort of a life guide that this famous shortstop, fictional shortstop, Aparicio Rodriguez has written. So I imagine Ozzy was probably the model on the field, but that more spiritual sort of figure, is there someone you had in mind when you were sort of hatching that character? Because that's another thing that's sort of rare in the sports world.
Yeah, no, I didn't have. I mean, I didn't have a particular athlete in mind. I mean, I think what I sort of vaguely had in mind in beginning to do that was just the way that, you know, a lot of the characters in the book have a sort of, you know, a lot of the book is about reading in a certain way. Mm-hmm. You know, for Mike Schwartz, you know, he's like he is writing his like college thesis about these like Stoic philosophers. Mm-hmm. And he sort of applies the principles of these Stoic philosophers like throughout his life in a really like, you know, hard ass sort of way, you know. And for Appenlight, it's these 19th century American writers that he loves so well, you know. And so I wanted Henry to have, even though, and Henry is a much less sort of literate and intellectual sort of guy than those other two. But I think it's true that we have these sort of things in our lives that serve as, you know, kind of models for how to live. You know, and so I think I wanted Henry to have that same sort of model. So, but I don't know of any really close cognate. Actually, I was just the other day. Somebody might know about this. I don't know about it, but someone was telling me. Apparently, there's a South American soccer writer who writes in something sort of similar to this kind of aphoristic way. Nobody knows.
Just go on Twitter.
Someone tweet that. There's another, I mean, one of the sort of themes that runs through the book is when you're getting inside of not just Henry's head, but all the players' heads. And you sort of, I thought you did a great job of something we try to do at SI all the time, which is sort of capture the mindset of an athlete. And you did it far better than we can do dealing with real athletes. But, not just the dynamic of being on a team, the banter, the sort of the love-hate relationship these guys have with each other, but also the sort of the psychology of an athlete, basically. And Henry, there are times in the book when Henry reflects on, you know, he's very much a creature of routine and ritual. He's almost a perpetual motion machine, and that's where he finds meaning and hard work and doing the same thing day after day and finding incremental improvements every day, and that sort of adds up over time to a great increase in ability and talent and this finished product of a baseball career. And so I'm reading these passages, talking, you know, whether Henry's running steps or fielding his 5,000th ground ball of the day, and he's thinking about this, you know, he's very much in the moment. How much of that was about being an athlete, and how much of that was about the writing process? I felt like you were sort of psyching yourself up for writing a book in some ways when you're going through some of these passages. I mean, I imagine the writer's life and the athlete's life in that way. Hard work, dedication. It's a lot of grunt work. It's not always glamour events like this.
It's not all like this.
Exactly. Yeah. I felt like I saw some similarities between the athlete and the writer's mindset there in some ways.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I guess it's right there in the title of the book. Like, I really, you know, think of these athletes as artists in a particular sort of way. You know, and, you know, probably in the same way that, you know, like 120, 150 years ago, there were a lot of novelists who, like, would write books about painters, you know, because they, like, wanted to write about themselves, but they're like, I can't write about myself, I'm going to write about this painter, and it's all going to be cool, you know? And, you know, and I was probably doing the same thing. In some ways you sort of have to draw on your own experience, you know, but I wanted to, you know, so I was sort of finding a way to do that by writing about these athletes. You know, I also, I think, you know, in my own life, I probably went through what a lot of people go through because sports are so crucial to a lot of to the way in which a lot of people grow up in America, you know, which is that I really, you know, when I was in junior high school and when I was in high school, I really like devoted myself to sports, and like sports was really what like organized my life, and it was what was important at my high school, and it was what, you know, what it did everything for you, right? Nobody cared like if you read a book, right? And then, you know, and then I like, and then I went to college, and that, and that whole world was gone, you know, but that, and that world is, you know, it's like you say, it's a world of sort of, it's a world of kind of seriousness and discipline and people telling you what to do. And then all of a sudden you're bereft of that and you're like, oh shit, like I have to like do everything for myself, you know? So I think there are like, I think there are a lot of young writers out there, a lot of people out there in any kind of fields who are like, I wish I had a coach like screaming at me every morning because I would be so much more efficient and so much better at what I do if someone would just scream at me every morning. You know, but that's, and so you sort of wish that other things were approached in the same way that, that serious sports are approached. Mm-hmm.
Do you
reach the end of my page?
No, well, you have it?
I have it.
Notes, that's a good idea. Yeah. All right, anything else? Or then Chad and I.
We could talk all night.
Okay.
Questions?
We'll do questions in a bit, but not yet. But 10 minutes? Okay, so Steve, thanks. Chad and I are going to chat now. All right, so as a lot of you probably know, Chad is one of the co-founders and co-editors of M Plus One, the magazine, which was your idea, right, to start that magazine?
Well, I don't know about
you
that.
You don't want to take too much credit? Okay, tell us how the magazine got off the ground. Who are your other, you know, co-editors, co-founders?
Well...
And when?
Yes. Well, so I get credit for the naming of the magazine. There were five of us. There were five founders of the magazine, and we and so one of the other founders and I, Keith Gessner and I, were friends in college, and then we graduated from college, and it was the late '90s, and we had no idea what to do with our lives, and so we were like, we're going to start a magazine, and we didn't actually do anything about this. We just Keith went and got married. And
were you roommates at the time? Or?
Well, not after. No, he had a wife.
Oh, right. That would be weird. Okay. Yeah.
I was like, can I come live with you guys? And they were like, maybe later. And
you were roommates at some point. That's when I met you guys. But okay.
Yeah, yeah, later on. After Keith got divorced. And, yeah, and so Keith and I were, dejected, confused post-college phase where you just like look around and you're like, there's all this stuff in the world, but I don't belong to any of it, but I think there's something I could do, but oh my god, it's so complicated, and but I have a degree, but nobody cares. And so the thing that we clung to for like these years was that we were gonna start a magazine. And then 5 years went by. And then we met three other guys who like were living like a parallel life in like a similar town a few hundred miles away, and they also were like, they were going to start a magazine, and we were like, what's your magazine like? And they were like, well, you know, it's like we all like studied literature, but we want to take this kind of literary and theoretical education that we have, and we want to like apply it to politics, and we want to like look at the contemporary world, and we, you know, and like there are all these magazines, but they're not really doing that. And we were like, that's exactly what our magazine was going to do. And so then it's like this thing where you're like, your bluff has been called, and
I got to do it.
Yeah, you're like, oh, now we like, you know, met the guys from across the street, mm-hmm. and so then the five of us got together, and in 2003 decided to actually do it, and then in 2004 put out our first issue of the magazine.
Cool. Which is three times a year? Four times?
Three times a year.
Yeah. Fritz. Yeah. So, and those guys, some of them, all of them, I don't know, went on to have success, published books, etc. And there you were working on your novel and unemployed at one point. And so, yeah, what, I guess, got you through those really low points, you know, when you're... And did you stay, you know, pretty devoted to your novel throughout, or were there periods where you just kind of let it go for a couple months, or was it always, was it like your saving grace?
What are you laughing at? No, I mean, it was not, it definitely was not always my saving grace. Like, and there were certainly, I mean, there were many periods where the novel was like laid aside for quite a while, for various reasons. Like, you know, sometimes it was laid aside for a while just because I was so busy with the magazine and so busy, like, trying to, you know, pay my rent that I, like, wouldn't have time from several months.
From which you took no income, right, from the magazine.
Yeah, none of us founders ever have ever made any money from the magazine. But then at a certain point, and this hasn't entirely ended, but I got very depressed about global warming. And, like, that prevented me from working on my book for, like, a really long time. I was like, why would anyone write a book? Mm-hmm. We're all going to die. And I still kind of feel that way, but I had to finish my book.
But you came here in your private jet. Right?
Yeah. From, like, 20 blocks away. Those things are true. I did despair of those things. Then I also just sort of despaired of, like, ever finishing the book, and at a certain point, because, you know, it took me, like, between the time that I really conceived of the book and the time that I, found Chris, that was, like, 10 years, mm-hmm. you know, which seems, that was really fun in retrospect, but, like, when you're at, like, year seven, or year seven and a half, or year eight, and you're not really in the finish line, it's not really in sight, like, you're just, you know, all your friends are like, what are you, Chad, what are you doing, mm-hmm. you know, and Keith, even in the Vanity Fair piece, which is, mm-hmm.
Keith wrote this, by the way, one of the co-founders,
yeah, one of my co-founders, you know, it's like the most gracious thing ever written, and it's so kind to me, but at one point, he's like, I just wish that Chad would, like, give it up, and, like, go on, move on, and, like, do something else, and, you know, and of course, I felt that myself, like, you know, because you can't actually tell that you're ever going to finish. You know, you just don't know how good you don't know if it's any good.
You're like a bazillion drafts at this point, or Word docs, or you write by hand, right?
Yeah, I write by hand and then I put it in the computer, but certainly there were, you know, there are millions of words in my computer, mm-hmm. you know. If you, like, went to my computer, you'd be like, this guy.
His brain would explode?
No, you're just like, this guy's crazy.
All right, so who were some people who, you know, were your, like, champions about, you'll get this done? Did you have those kind of people in your life, whether they were teachers in the MFA program or, you know, early believers in the book? And, or was it just you?
Yeah, I had some champions. Some of them are in the room. Mm-hmm. Matthew Thomas and Stephen Boykevich. Like, you know, I had friends who really, like, believed in the project. And yet, like, I wasn't, you know, in throughout all this time, like, I was really working on the thing in solitude, and I wasn't even, you know, showing it to them with any sort of regularity. So it was, you know, it was really sort of in some ways, it's a sort of situation in which you, I had to keep going because I just had, at a certain point, you just, you're like, I can't give it up. I've come this far. You know, I have to just see it through. And it may take me 3 years, or it may take me, you know, 30 years, or, you know, and when I finish it, it may not be of any use to anyone at all. But I've worked so hard on it for so long, mm-hmm. that it would just be foolish to, you know, I can't let it go. So you're just kind of like, in this very kind of banal way, sort of like locked into going ahead.
Yeah. All right.
That wasn't the most inspiring.
No, it was. In a way, I was going to say maybe that's a great place to end. Let's see. What is something like about the writing of the book that you've gotten so much publicity and been interviewed so many times? Is there anything, you know, surprising that you want people to know about? I don't know. What was like the most, in all this publicity, what has been the most surreal moment? Like, when did you kind of know what a big deal this was? And
well, I don't want to talk about that.
Oh, come on.
It's true. I mean, it's really true that you know, I was very, you know, the Sports Illustrated thing. It was they really led us along for a long time. And I know it's not Steve's fault. I know he was.
They were like, I think we're maybe going to do it. And I was like so excited about it because, you know, because like as a kid growing up in Wisconsin, like Sports Illustrated was the very first magazine that I ever knew existed, you know? And, you know, I subscribed to it, and, like, I think Chris was probably the same, you know, the same way that, like, I was a subscriber to Sports Illustrated. I, like, you know, probably got it as, like, a Christmas present when I was in fourth grade or something. And, you know, I remember, like, the first couple years that I got Sports Illustrated, you know, back in those days, the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. You know, it wasn't actually a full, you might not even remember this, young man, but it was not actually a full and independent issue, but it was just sort of embedded in an issue, and there was just like, you know, 30 pages of swimsuits. And so in these first couple years when I was like a kid, my parents, they would remove that part. And they would,
maybe you can go to the swimsuit issue party this year. Really shut them up.
Can you do that?
Maybe that, but I can get you those parts you missed.
Yeah, like 1986, is that? But it was a profound experience for me because then I would get this Sports Illustrated and it would just like the staples would be sort of like already done in the middle, you know? And I would just like imagine this whole world that was like contained in that like unbent staple.
Should write a book about that.
Yeah. And that was like my whole like adolescence right there.
We're gonna wrap this up and then we'll start a new podcast for the Q&A, but thanks everyone.